to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And today, I'm very excited to have writer-director Jennifer Reeder here with me. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
For those of you who aren't as familiar with Jennifer's work, please let me give you an introduction. Jennifer is an Ohio-born and Chicago-based filmmaker, artist, and professor who earned her MFA from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Early in her career, she drew upon her roots broke into the art scene with performance and video work under the moniker White Trash Girl, an alter ego she used to explore class identity, which was also ultimately included in the book White Trash, Race and Class in America. Throughout her career, she straddled the line of hard art and indie filmmaking, constructing personal fiction films about relationships, trauma, and coping, borrowing from a range of forms including after-school specials, amateur music videos, and magical realism. These films include her numerous shorts that have played and taken prizes at Sundance, Berlin, Rotterdam, South by Southwest, the Venice Biennale, the Whitney Biennial, and a bunch of other ones. She directed her first feature, Accidents at Home and How They Can Happen, in 2008, and then in 2017 released her follow-up feature, Signature Move, about a Muslim lesbian who finds her identity by falling in love with a Mexican woman and luchador wrestling. This year marks the release of her third feature, Knives and Skin, a hyper-real and often hilarious narrative deconstructing the cliche of the murdered girl in a small town. Jennifer has been financially supported by the Rooftop Adrian Shelley Foundation, the Hamburg Film Fund, and with a Creative Capital grant in Moving Image. She is a USA Artist nominee for 2008, 2015, 2016, and 2017, and a Herb Alpert Film Award nominee. She's currently Associate Professor of Moving Image at the University of Illinois Chicago, which I once got kicked out of Illinois Chicago.
Oh.
I didn't go to school there. I was just partying there.
Great.
They told me not to come back.
Great.
So I assume it's still got rigorous standards there.
I mean, not on my watch.
Oh.
You know, that might have been West Campus.
Your film Knives and Skin, I saw at Fantastic Fest and just absolutely adored it. Can you tell people when that's coming out? Is it December 6th?
December 6th through IFC Midnight in theaters and VOD.
Okay. All right. So we'll get back to that. But today, Jennifer, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Safe, and by Todd Haynes. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your favorite genre films?
For sure. So I remember seeing it in a theater when it came out at the Music Box, which is a beautiful vintage theater in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from the very first frame of the film through the very end of it, I just watched it with my mouth hanging open. Based on not just the story, but the pacing, the art direction. I mean, Carol White is a character, an unforgettable character who has actually made her way into every single one of my own female characters. I think I had seen Todd's Karen Carpenter story, Superstar,
mm-hmm.
much previous to that.
Yeah.
And so was kind of, curious about Safe. And I just became obsessed with it, and it's probably my most favorite film, or in the top three. So I'm really glad that we get to talk about it.
Yeah, I can see some parallels, more than some. I can see a lot of parallels in what you're doing, specifically in Knife and Skin and then also in Safe. So for those of you who haven't seen Safe, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Safe first, this is your chance. This is one of those movies I don't think you can spoil either. So,
right.
Now let me introduce Safe with a quick synopsis. Written and directed by Todd Haynes for release in 1995, Safe stars Julianne Moore as Carol White, a typical affluent suburban woman in the San Fernando Valley circa 1987. Carol leads a full but sterile life. We see her gardening, going to aerobics classes and running errands, doing a bunch of stuff with friends. Sometimes we see her husband, who is neither affectionate nor mean, but just simply there, a husband.
Honey, can you call the landscapers again about the sod? I gotta get moving on that, you know, or we're gonna miss.
I'll try them again.
Thanks, hon.
Everything in Carol's life, including Carol, seems distant. She also has a stepson. Their relationship is also nothing to write home about. But as Carol continues going through the motions of her lovely, sterile life, she begins to feel ill. Her symptoms are unpredictable, erratic, and strange. Suddenly, she feels totally fatigued but can't explain it. Then, when a truck passes her, she begins coughing uncontrollably on its exhaust while everyone else seems fine. And that kind of begins the spark of a downfall of Carol, because a perm at the hair salon gives her a bloody nose, a baby shower triggers an asthma attack, vomiting, shaking, all of it, and she never knows when it's coming, like some invisible force is surrounding her with potential danger at every turn. Doctors can only find a milk allergy.
I really don't see anything wrong with you, Carol. I mean, outside of a slight rash and congestion.
Carol believes she suffers from something called MCS, multiple chemical sensitivity, a little-known disease that some people believe is imagined, where low doses of everyday chemicals make the sufferer chronically ill.
Your family and friends tell you that you're overreacting, that it's all in your head. But your symptoms worsen. Fatigue and depression turn to migraines, blackouts, even seizures. Now, if this sounds familiar, you're not alone. What you most likely are is one of a vastly growing number of people who suffer from environmental illness.
Psychotherapy doesn't help, so she turns to New Age practitioners, attending a retreat at a desert ranch called Renwood. There, she meets others like herself, and they listen to a leader who instills in them that the power to be healed lies within themselves.
Because when you look out on the world from a place of love and a place of forgiveness, what you are seeing outside is a reflection of what you feel within.
This is a kind of muddled message that Carol gets. People aren't quite sure if they're getting what they need. And the story ends in a kind of circular pattern where Carol is breathing from a machine and looking into the darkness, wondering what's next.
Right. I mean, it's one of the first films that I saw that left me gutted at the end. I mean, I think that Todd Haynes has a tendency to do that. I would consider him a feminist filmmaker, but he oftentimes leaves his female leads in a lower place than when they started. And the ending of Safe, and I just rewatched it in anticipation of this conversation, mm-hmm. is gutting. I have never seen a film end like that. And, you know, I don't necessarily, well, that might be, get spoiled, although it's also not, it's a gutting ending, but also not remarkable. I mean, there's every single moment in this film, from the delivery of the wrong color couch at the beginning to, you know, when like the low level starting to unravel, you mm-hmm. know, I just think that I had never seen a film that dealt with, I mean, you mentioned White Trash Girl. So I had been sort of thinking about whiteness for a while at that period of time, and what are representations of whiteness? What does whiteness look like? How to unpack whiteness outside of something like white power, you know, which is not something I was interested in. And this was a film that really felt like it was about a white woman, you know, mm-hmm. and what that meant and how deep that meant.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Okay, so there's a couple of things that you brought up that I definitely have some notes on that I want to go to. First, I'm going to go back to the kind of torturing of the female characters that you said, you know, mm-hmm. like this kind of like letting them suffer and they don't necessarily get their reprieve. Because Todd Haynes talks a lot about Hitchcock when he talks about Safe. He said, quote, "Most overtly, I was thinking about the TV disease films when I made this, but the film language of horror films was also inspirational. I love that moment in Hitchcock when you know something is about to happen and suspense is created by prolonging the ordinary mundane events that precede this event. He got off on it. He got off on torturing his heroines. He makes us get off on it too. It's the most interesting thing that he did. He made the viewer get off on it and paralleled to that what is innately pleasurable in watching movies. But Hitchcock takes a lot more pleasure in torturing his heroine than I do in Safe, whatever that means." Mm-hmm. So he was kind of disavowing himself in that sense.
Right.
Where like he's not quite letting her get, you know, attacked by birds. But there, I mean, I can see when he talks about Hitchcock and horror, I can absolutely see in the composition of his shots and the way that he approaches the camera finding Carol in the scene. There is so much here that he's building with the same kind of atmosphere of just like letting his leading lady kind of squirm and letting, you know, the environment just kind of do its terrible bidding, you know?
Oh, 100%. And I just rewatched Marnie, which is maybe one of my favorite Hitchcocks, and the way that he uses, the same as Todd Haynes, these slow camera movements, these slow zooms, and where in Marnie there's lots of use of color to trigger a kind of a psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same in Safe, but in a much more nuanced way. It's like the color, that's like that unrelenting pastels in Safe become that kind of a psychological tick.
Yeah. I mean, in your film, you have these kind of unrelenting, you know, like magentas and these kind of these hotter colors that are, you know, like you're clearly using these gels and kind of putting these lights and these colors to the extreme of realism. And like there's still things that are real happening, but there's a heightened realism happening.
Right. And I think that, I mean, that was also super intentional, and I think, you know, comes directly from my history as, you know, an art school kid, not a film school kid,
mm-hmm.
and my history even as a ballet dancer. You know, there's something that's, you know, the dramatic lighting of a stage, a theatrical stage,
yep.
has always, you know, drawn me in. And even literally in my own house, I feel like I have dramatic cinema lighting in my own house. The minute someone comes in and sort of turns on the overhead light, it's as though, you know, I have an allergic reaction to it. So, but in Knives and Skin, it felt like I wanted the lighting to indicate that this world that you're in is hovering just above reality.
Yep.
But it also felt important that those colors, you know, no gender owns pink and purple. But I wanted it to feel like femme. There's like this vibrating femme energy, let's say.
Yeah.
And there's something significant about the color pink as an emblem, let's say. So it's like that, you know, there's like Knives and Skin is like, yeah, like vibrating with like super pink.
Well, I think that kind of brings me to this next thing that I want to talk about, which is the environment that we're creating. Todd Haynes said, "I'm definitely drawn to minimalism aesthetically. I think it's beautiful, and so the film is beautiful to me. Although, what's beautiful about Safe is also hard and rigid and cold and controlled, and so it's scary. I definitely felt the need to depict Carol constantly in relation to her environment and as part of its architecture. We were trying to define her and feel her and find her as a character, but we always did it in relation to her space. You don't really have full access to the character, to her psychology, history, things that were usually pretty quickly given to the access to in the movie, but you have access to her environment."
Exactly. And I think that that's something that I also noticed from the beginning. And the way that he composes, that Todd Haynes composes the frames,
mm-hmm.
in Safe in particular, you know, she's often sort of right in the middle and we're zooming in, and she is, you know, she has a sort of a place in the structure of that frame, whether it's a mirror that's over here, there's a painting, there's the horizontal back of the couch. It's also it's really rigid in particular. And so when that pattern starts to break down, like,
yeah.
we all feel the unease of that. Even something like the milk that she drinks at the beginning, sort of,
yeah.
unrelentingly, like that's really all we know about her, right? Like we really don't know anything about her. Even at the end, she's like a really unknowable character,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so all we know about her at the beginning, I mean, we were introduced obviously to her husband and her stepson. And we know she likes milk, but she's a very, she's a really untethered character, you know, in the sense that, for instance, she meets with one of her friends that suggests that she start the fruit diet. So that's what she does. Then someone else suggests this. So that's what she does. And, you know, even though Haynes leaves her in this very still unknowable place at the end of the film, there's something that's still sympathetic.
Yeah.
And I think that with all of the, like, the art direction, the dialogue, everything that goes together to make this film, and for sure, Julianna Moore's performance, I think he's asking you for empathy, you know, to be empathetic, super empathetic. So at the end, I mean, I love this film, but every time I watch it, I feel a little queasy at the end.
No,
you know, I feel
absolutely.
Totally sick to my stomach, right? And so it's, again, it's like, you know, sobbing through Far From Heaven, which I remember the person who I was watching it with turned to me and he was like, kept saying like, are you okay? Do you need to live? I was like, I'm fine. I just, you know, and then with Safe, just being kind of like, oh, I'm for sure going to barf everybody. And, you know, and that the assumption like, oh, so you hated it. And like, no, I loved it. I'm going to watch it again. You know,
yeah, skin crawling.
Showing. Yeah.
And, you know, I should share a quote that Tawn Haynes said about Julianne Moore. Her character is, quote, there are many more people like her in the world than the ones with strong personalities we're used to seeing on film. People aren't taught to project themselves in dynamic, articulate ways. And most people aren't gorgeous or absolutely sure of who they are. I know that I make films. I'm an artist. But there are times when I don't really know who I am. The unconscious assumption of who we are and what we're here for, those questions are fragile in most people's minds. There are times when that unconscious self of ourselves slips through our fingers.
Oh, that's really brilliant. And that's something that I was thinking about in the last comment that I made, that even though Carol White is a really like, she's like Braille in butter, you know, she's an unknowable character, but it clearly, you know, Haynes, who constructed her, loves her and cares about her deeply. And I feel like she's, again, even though she's this unknowable character, she's extremely dimensional and complex in my view, as opposed to another character in another film that also feels unknowable, that somehow just remains really flat and undimensional, you know? And I think that as someone who, you know, loves to experience strong female characters both in my real life and my film life, Carol White's, her like dimensionality, you know, it doesn't come from this you know, determination and self-possession and typical kind of strength. It's much more normal and nuanced. And the fact that her arc is so dramatic, and that maybe at the end what we realize is that, you know, she can't turn back. She will never go back to that other, the life at the hair salon, mm-hmm. or the, you know, the teal couch,
yeah,
world.
She's
she will
changed.
Never. She's forever changed, and in that way, then I mean, I feel like that's how I've found the feminism in a way in this, you know, in this film, that she is forever changed and will never ever return to that, even if she continues to, you know, spiral downwards. Although I don't know how more down you can go from where she is at the end. Although there is the other character in the film who I like a lot, whose name is Philip. Is it Philip? Who's the completely covered.
I think that is, yeah.
Character who you just see kind of awkwardly walking.
He's like the cover of the Criterion, I believe.
In the background. I mean, maybe that's the next phase for her.
I think it is. There's always places to go. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about unknowable characters in your film as well. And then some more of the choices that Julianne Moore is making. And also the idea of making movies outside of L.A. Mm-hmm. We'll be right back.
This week on Bullseye, Lin-Manuel Miranda on His Dark Materials, hip-hop, and life after Hamilton.
I know it's the first line of my obituary, so if that line is handled, then what else can I do with my time here?
It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jennifer Reeder, and we're talking about
Safe.
Yes, that's the first time someone said it with me. I love it. I feel like we're in sync, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to the idea of the unknowable character. How can you have an unknowable character who is also dynamic, who could be extremely weak, but is also dynamic to watch on screen? Your movie has a lot of these characters, and I'm thinking specifically of your mother character. There's a girl who is, we're not quite sure what happens to her, but we kind of see something happen to her. And so this girl never comes home. There's like a missing girl in the story, and we're looking for like who she is, where is she? And her mother is slowly unraveling, but she's just kind of, I don't want to describe her as like a Stepford wife, but she is very calm and restrained, but she's also losing her mind. Can
yes.
you talk about how you kind of make that character work?
Sure. So, I mean, I really think in real life, most people are, unless well, including ourselves, are unknowable, right? So then you have to kind of look for the clues around them, and kind of even going back to what Haynes was saying about the, you know, how we know Carol White, we know her through her environment. I feel like I've tried to adapt that in so many of my films, because people don't tell you who they are. You have to find out who they are.
Yeah.
And even, you know, and people sort of show you who they are in certain circumstances, you know, and there's all sorts of things that happen in one's private life while one is completely solitary. And that's maybe where the knowable things happen and no one else gets to see them.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, the mom characters in this film, I wanted to borrow a little bit from moms in most films, which are also very one-dimensional. You know, mm-hmm. they're these kind of peripheral, like a peripheral role that you don't really ever get to know, and they don't really propel the story forward, so who cares? I mean, they could be there or not be there. And oftentimes they're daffy, wet blankets. So I wanted to make some moms that were difficult in a way, unpenetrable, because I also think that both in real life and cinematically, and maybe I'll just start with real life, there's some kind of assumption that happens when a woman becomes a mother about her her capacity to care.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that there are a lot of women who feel totally ambivalent about motherhood or even resentful about motherhood, and realizing that they're bad at caring.
Yeah.
And that caring is, you have to learn how to care, you have to learn how to nurture. And so there's just this sense that somehow mothers have this ability to kind of wrap the care around you and in that way, lose themselves in that gesture. And so
yeah.
they are only, you know, sympathetic, maybe bordering on empathetic, and their needs and, you know, don't have like wash away the moment that they become a mother, because all of their energy becomes focused on their children. And which is like, oh, that's a real problematic, you know, way to think about motherhood, both in real life and in films. And so I wanted to try to write, even though my characters are they still hover above reality, I actually wanted to try and write some moms that actually felt a little more authentic, that were a little closed, a little more opaque, mm-hmm. a little more inaccessible, yes, ambivalent to motherhood, if not completely resisting it. Or conversely, with one of the characters who is pregnant, that's all I'll say about her, she's actually consumed by her role as a potential mother, but it's also part of her psychosis that has nothing to do with her ability to nurture or care.
Yeah.
Right. And I think about Lisa Harper, who's Carolyn Harper's mother, and the way that she is.
And Carolyn Harper is the missing girl.
Carolyn Harper's the missing girl. And, you know, I just was thinking about what the unspeakable horror of not knowing where your child is and still having to function in the world through that.
Especially when you're not like the super mom.
Oh,
you know, like,
yeah.
She's like very sad about it, but it's just like, you know, she's not the kind of sad that you would see on the news necessarily.
That would be
appropriately sad. I want to get into some of these performance choices that we're getting. Because one is that Todd Haynes felt that Julianne Moore was the only one who had the kind of restraint of the actors that he saw that he needed from her, that he would, you know, like we were saying, just kind of like let her slowly appear on the screen. He said, quote, "I think she understood it completely in an innate way. Her approach is not to overly theorize what she's doing or to do tons of method preparation. Her courage as an actress was in knowing how little to do to communicate Carol's paralysis. This is something many actors don't understand. Some people can't open their mouths very big, can't move their eyes very far, can't move their necks very far when they're suffering from MCS. There are reasons why each of these things is blocked or limited, and that's something for an actor to use. But instead of demonstrating all the blockages and all the limitations, she was so incredibly secure about how to approach it. So it was very small things. There's a really wonderful scene, for instance, where she's just having like a little lunch with her girlfriend, and she's explaining to her, like, kind of in rambling sentences.
And you know our couch? Our beautiful new couch?
Yeah.
Totally toxic.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. So, it's hard. Like, I can't wear makeup anymore.
God.
It burns my eyes. I get sick.
Well, I guess one good thing is just how it's made you so much more knowledgeable on food and everything and chemicals.
That's true.
And she's just kind of like rambling, and she can see that her friend is uncomfortable, and she's also in pain. Like, Carol's in pain, and she's just trying to be in the outside world. And there's just these tiny ticks. Mm-hmm. It's not like a big, like she's not being like, oh, groaning and like rubbing herself or something. She's very restrained and kept inside still. Like, she's true to her character still.
Right. And I think that that's what, I mean, and even the smallness of her voice, you know, this little soft voice that she speaks in almost the whole time, that's like a little, that's like sort of chirpy and unsure. It's really extraordinary, those little moments. And I do think that there's something that's just about Juliana Moore's face in general. She's mm-hmm. got one of those kind of faces where her mouth never doesn't close naturally,
mm-hmm.
you know, or that's what it seems like. I've never met her in person to test that out, you know, but there's something about that that I've always been fascinated by, that sort of facial structure of someone who their resting face is like an open mouth mm-hmm. face, you know, which makes them seem like curious and wondering and mm-hmm. absorbing, you know, when maybe that's not the case at all. There's like a different, so even though her character is, yeah, super restrained, that kind of way that her resting face is still like an open-mouthed face,
yeah,
makes her also seem like really like vulnerable, and as though she's experiencing every moment for the very first time.
Yeah, which kind she's of, a mewling kitten, you know?
You know, for sure. And then it makes those moments like when she has the kind of seizure at the baby shower, you know, just so like monstrous. Like, she becomes a monster
mm-hmm.
in that scene. And she is a monster in a way at the end, because like she's physically transformed. You know, she seems to be at least, you know, like so much thinner and more fragile. And she's got this developing head wound. Like, she really is all of that restraint, everything that started from, well, before she was born, it's like it's slowly beginning to ooze out of her. And she's really a monster at the end, even though, again, it's like extremely subtle.
Yeah, she's the monster in this horror story, we'll say. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some process stuff with crews, getting your DPs together, how a movie gets made. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Jesse Thorne. We're very happy to announce that tickets for Max FunCon 2020 will go on sale Friday, November 29th at 11 a.m. Pacific. I also want to let you know, this coming year, Max FunCon 2020 will be our last Max FunCon for the foreseeable future. For 2020 and beyond, we're going to be looking for ways to connect with more of you in person and spread the spirit of Max Fun farther than it's ever gone before. In the meantime, if you want to join us at the last Max Fun Con in Lake Arrowhead, June 12th through the 14th, you can find details at maxfuncon.com.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jennifer Reeder, and we're talking about Safe. Okay, so here's something that Todd Haynes had a problem with while trying to get this movie made. He said, quote, "I wanted to work with New York DP Maurice Alberti, who had shot Poison and Dottie Gets Spanked, but she was pregnant at the time. So I started talking to people in L.A. The differences between New York and L.A., particularly in low-budget filmmaking, became clearer and clearer to me. The L.A. mentality is dominated by the industry in every possible way. It's all by the money. So we ended up hiring the people who work for $850 a week. Basically, the L.A. sexploitation crews." So all of SAFE was done by people who were usually just doing, you know, sex work stuff in the Valley for a while. And then, like, some folks who kind of were trying to break further into the industry. But, yeah, like, they weren't in the unions or anything, and they
That's
just had to get it.
Unbelievable.
I think he had $1 million budget for this movie.
That's unbelievable.
That Christine Vachon mm-hmm. got for him. Mm-hmm. Always his biggest champion.
Right.
And to me, I think that's a really interesting thing about this, because the movie is very much L.A. It is very much San Fernando Valley and this particular type of valley-ness. But to make it here, he really had to kind of pull a lot of strings. It wasn't an easy process to get it outside of the industry. Your film, too. I mean, like, I know in Q&As before, you've talked a little bit about the fact that people said you weren't going to be able to get all the actors that you needed in Chicago. Clearly, you got all these actors. There's talent everywhere. Talent exists everywhere. It's not always just in Los Angeles, as we find when these wonderful people crop up. But you're still fighting against people saying that, like, you need the best, you need this, you need Maurice Alberti doing this, you know?
Right. No, and, you know, I live in Chicago. I wanted to shoot it in Chicago. I wanted to go home at the end of the day and sleep in my own bed like a normal person. And I've shot a bunch of shorts in Chicago, and so I knew that there was crew there. And more, it's much easier to shoot something in Chicago than it was 10 years ago, mm-hmm. for better or for worse, because of there's a lot of TV that's being shot in Chicago now. So there's more, you know, people who are graduating from those film schools are staying in Chicago rather than going to New York or LA.
Yeah.
And so there's skilled crew. And Chicago's always been a theater town that has amazing performers, you know. So, yeah. And I've worked a lot with theater people and even improv comedy people from Chicago who have never, it's never been a directing issue where I can't kind of get their performances down for the camera. You
yeah,
know?
A lot of people are just like, oh, no, it's too much work because they're too big for the stage and they can't adjust. But it's like, well,
I feel like that's your fault as the director, you know. That's never been.
What do you tell them to adjust? Like, what's your
magic
words?
Well, I've never even
words?
Had to. You know, I mean, it's never even had to. Like, those, because, I mean, right now, the people who were in Knives and Skin, a lot of them have a lot of TV and film experience now. So they kind of do a little bit of both. So they yeah. know, they like know what their faces do when a camera is 3 inches.
Yeah.
And then they know what to do when they're on, I mean, they're actors, they're professionals. So they also know what to do when they're on a stage and they have to hit the back of the room. But for me, theater actors and even improv comedy comedians are used to performing in front of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of risk and ability to sort of put it out there in a live environment, I think makes them, you know, there's like an edge there that I think
there's a fearlessness.
A fearlessness, exactly. That's the word I was looking for. So then when you write these kind of off characters, everybody who read the script, no one said, I don't understand this character, or I don't want to play someone that's that opaque or weird or something. I mean, they were just like,
theater
yes,
people are
let's
weird.
Get
yeah.
into it. Yeah, people are weird. Humans are weird. But I loved the fearlessness of the people in this film. And also, I think because all of them are used to performing live, they can kind of call up a change in character, you know, like that, right? Everything is just right there under the surface. I mean, I feel like they're not good people to date because of that,
mm-hmm.
you know? But cast
Don't
them.
Watch Knives and Skin to date the cast.
It's not a dating app.
I wanted to bring up the fact that Todd Haynes, on looking back on SAFE, he was thinking about the process in which he was working with specific actors throughout his career. When he made Carol specifically, he was talking about working in Cincinnati and hiring people from Cincinnati to be his background, and that there was something that was really fluid and wonderful and natural about them that you didn't get from a lot of background actors in LA who felt very stiff and wooden and couldn't perform simple tasks because they were trying to think about how it looks on camera. And, you know, he also talked a little bit about Poison, one of his earlier films. Mm-hmm. And he said, quote, "All the speaking parts were actors in Save. Unlike Poison, where I used a combination of actors and non-actors, I think I'm spoiled for life by the quality of the actors I worked with. They brought that sense of reality to everything they did. Even the extras who my brother Sean cast were excellent, because extras have to act too. Directors forget. There's always that species of extra in movies who are so wooden." And he's talking about Safe. He said, "My nurse, however, couldn't spray the spray can. I just kept shooting her over and over again, and it took so much time away."
Oh, Lord.
Because he had to cast, you know, someone who was not an actual nurse. Mm-hmm. And then he was just like, if I could do it again, I'd probably, like, fire her. Just bring
cast
in
a nurse.
Like, is there a medic on set who mm-hmm. could step in mm-hmm. and just do this, and you're my nurse now?
Yeah. I've loved working with a combination. In the shorts that I made leading up to Knives and Skin, which are all on Vimeo, I've loved working with a combination of professional trained actors and non-actors. And oftentimes the non-actors are young people mm-hmm. who sometimes they have had a little bit of experience in, like, the high school musical, or they have a band with their friends. So they at least have an idea of, like, that their bodies exist in space, mm-hmm. you know, and that their face is emotive. But their reactions are really authentic. And so putting two people in a room together, like a really experienced, maybe adult actor who can draw out something very subtle and interesting and genuine in a non-actor, and then the non-actor kind of giving a line in an unexpected way to the professional actor that makes them genuinely, say their lines in a way that feels authentic.
Yeah,
that combination is my favorite.
I want to talk a little bit about what Todd Haynes calls his idea of keeping what every other Hollywood film would cut out. He said, quote, "Safe won't have that effect on everyone, but I did feel my own frustration with the volume and aggressivity of current Hollywood film practice, where each film has to outshriek, outpace the next. And the amount of histrionics and technological gimmickry and assault that each film displays, one-upping the next again and again. I walk out of those films absolutely numb, feeling nothing, because they assume everything. Whereas a Chantal Ackerman film is a real inspiration because it's so restrained and resistant. What you see in it in real time is what every other movie would cut out, but it creates a suspense and curiosity and a huge role for the viewer in the telling."
Oh, 100%. I mean, in Safe in particular, the pacing is excruciating and so patient. And the framing is very specific. You know, it's almost shot like a stage play.
I have a good quote about this. He said, "The basic, almost funny restriction that we placed on ourselves was this restrained coverage and distance from the character. The joke was, okay, let's move in for a close-up, but we never got very close. All of our proportions were appropriately adjusted from the starting point, which was very wide. Minimal camera movement." So they would joke, they would be like, "Let's go in for a close-up." But the close-up is just, like, the slowest mm-hmm. push-in, and you never actually get close. It's just, but it's still enough to be jarring, because even though you're still far away from her, you've been further away from her for so much longer, just, like, patiently waiting to get closer.
Right, which I think is why that very final scene where it's like, maybe we are as close to her in that final scene as we have ever been, and it's that nice wide shot. She's right in the center. It's such a perfectly composed frame, mm-hmm. and, you know, she's whispering, "I love you. I really love you." It's just, you can barely hear it, and you know, the combination of those three things again. Then that's, you know, the nausea kicks in and doesn't let up for the next 24 hours. But again, stay 5 feet from everybody.
Yeah.
I love also that Philip character that you see kind of walking. There's, like, nice, big, wide landscape, and he's walking with that crazy, that real particular kind of awkwardness through the landscape. All you want to do is get closer to that character and sort of check out what he's wearing and figure out what his deal is. And Todd Haynes won't let you. You know, it's that kind of...
like, we never get to know that person.
Never. And keeping something, keeping all of that at a distance, I think actually... for me, at least, as the audience member for this film, just drew me in. You know, I'm a really nosy person, and I can be a kind of a follower and like a close getter-upper. Like, my instinct in real life also is to kind of go through somebody's medicine cabinet and look in their refrigerator, you know, judge their book collection, or judge if they don't have books even more, you know, judge how they wind the cables on set, you know, and so. I always want to get closer, and so Todd Haynes does this really great way of creating that want in you, but never giving it to you, you know. And so then you're left just as kind of gutted at the end, but still deeply satisfied.
And you know, just like the one last thing that I'll share before we go is the fact that this was filmed during the big Northridge earthquake. Oh. In LA, very close to the epicenter. And it was something that was leaking and bleeding through into the movie of Safe, because it felt like there was just a general paranoia on set. Todd Haynes said that this place that he was staying in, the apartment with his producers and his DP, across the street had turned into an emergency shelter and a water station. And it was constantly a huge thing of fear. And that while they were filming, there were aftershocks. There's that moment where Julianne Moore is delivering a kind of rambling speech at the end of her birthday celebration, and you get these reactions of Peter Friedman and Kate McGregor Stewart, who played Peter, and Claire, and James LaGrosse as well, and they're all looking at her. And what's happening during that scene is there's a huge aftershock. It was one of the biggest aftershocks, and so you can almost see a kind of vibrational effect on the screen as that's happening. The only other person I can think of who's actually used that kind of earthquake thing is Peter Weir in Picnic at Hanging Rock, who also uses aftershocks and earthquakes in Picnic at Hanging Rock and embraces the kind of shakiness that was happening on screen.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I thought that was, you know, like real life is bleeding through
right
into the movie.
Well, I was going to say one more quick thing is that also that, you know, this film, even though it was made, you know, in the mid-90s, it's supposed to take place in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so
New York Times famously said that it took place in a future world. And Todd Haynes was just like, this was 1987. Everything looks like, but they thought it was a future world.
What are these floral pastels and puffy shoulders that we shall, that will turn into wings in the future?
Yeah.
But there's something, and of course there's like that sense of that, of the, there's a character who one of her friends, right, talks about the, who is the relative who died? And it's like an unspeakable death, right?
Yeah.
And we sort of imagine that they're talking about AIDS and the AIDS crisis.
Because they are.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's something that's so also really thinking about the film through the lens of what was happening, you know, culturally and politically during the 80s.
Yeah.
That's never pointed to directly, but it is that kind of, it is the earthquake underneath the film, where it's that hazy pink,
yes,
you know, cloud that's
this
over
is an
the
AIDS
entire
movie.
Film. It's an AIDS movie.
It is absolutely an AIDS
right.
movie. It was meant to be an AIDS movie.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be a backlash to anyone who said that you are responsible for your own bad health.
Right.
And
yes. So how do you, so it's like if you were to describe that and say like, oh, let's go see Safe. It's a horror AIDS movie. And then that's what you get. You would never imagine those
like,
things.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was that's a good place to
sure.
stop off, I would say. Jennifer, again, people can see Knives and Skin in the U.S. December 6th. In what cities? In all cities?
Yeah, so it's about 25 cities right now. New York or L.A., Chicago, Boston, Seattle, all the draft houses. So if you live in any corner of Texas, it's coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
Places also like Denver and Tallahassee, Mentor, Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio.
Ohio was represented.
Ohio was represented. But it'll be on, IFC's VOD, but it'll be on iTunes also for the first 90 days, then Hulu.
And then some international stuff, too. I know it's going to be big in France.
Big
we already know
in France.
Big in France. Jennifer Reeder, Knives and Skin, big in France. Thank you so much for coming and talking
thank
to
you,
me
April.
Today. And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, I'll read it on air. We've got one from editor Mom Lady. I like that name. Smart women talking about fascinating and weird movies. This speaks right to me. I love it so much. Well, we love you. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Totally toxic.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.